Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans about their civilian career. We talk about what they do, how they got there, and advice for other veterans seeking to do the same. Today is episode number 149 with Patrick Cleary.
And that's where, you know, veterans looking to get into finance or operations and being apprehensive, oh, I don't know finance, or oh, I don't know cybersecurity. Operational readiness, readiness checklists, training teams, supervising, those are skills that are transferable across the world. And frankly, most civilians are not exposed to that as much as we are. So there's certainly an opportunity for veterans to get into a field like this. You just have to understand that you have those transferable skills.
Well, I hope that all of you listened to episode 134 with Wes Gray, who told an inspiring story of how he went from the military to start Alpha Architect, a company that I found in the Wall Street Journal talking about one of the fastest growing and most impressive investment funds in the universe. That's paraphrased, but I'm pretty sure that's pretty close to true. My guest today, Patrick, was introduced to me by Wes. He does work at Alpha Architect as well, and I think this is just an absolutely incredible interview. A couple reasons to listen, if that's not endorsement enough. We talk about so many things on this. We talk about choosing a team that is lean and mean. We talk about Patrick's journey from not being sure what to do for, you know, a 5 to 6 year period, wandering from business school to consulting again, but ultimately finding a place he passionately calls home. We talk about work-life balance. It's probably the best discussion I've ever had on the show about work-life balance, and really caused me to think of that in a different way. We talk about finance, the world of financial services, entrepreneurship. It's just a must-listen no matter what your career intentions are. And I'm trying out something new. If you stick around after this episode, I'm going to do something besides just ask you to leave an iTunes review, I promise. We're going to do a little debrief. I'm going to share what stood out to me from this interview, and I would invite you to share your thoughts as well in the show notes. I would love to get a discussion going because I know we can extract even more value from this incredible interview by chatting about it on beyondtheuniform.io in the show notes, where you will also find links to all the different books and resources that Patrick talks about in this discussion. Lots of great books that I'm planning on reading. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with Patrick at Alpha Architect. Joining me today in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is Pat Cleary. Pat, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So for listeners, I wanted to give a quick background on Pat. He is the Chief Operations Officer at Alpha Architect. He started out at the University of Pennsylvania, after which he served as a platoon commander in the United States Marine Corps for 4 years. After his active duty service, he received his MBA from Harvard Business School, worked as a project leader at the Boston Consulting Group, and worked at the global business service provider Algeco Scotsman Group. So maybe, Pat, just to start things off, right now you work in the financial services industry as both a chief operations officer as well as a chief compliance officer. How would you explain that role to someone who's on active duty right now?
Sure. Great question. So a COO, CCO in finance is all about compliance and all about attention to detail. You're basically like a lieutenant that's responsible for everything and anything that the unit fails to do in terms of, you know, day-to-day execution of the job as well as compliance matters. So I'll give you an example. We're in a highly regulated industry. There's all sorts of rules, regs, and other items that we have to adhere to. I'm responsible for making sure we do all of that stuff. So there's an entire infrastructure we've built that basically makes sure, okay, have we filed these forms? Have we checked on these valuations? Has XYZ trader done ABC task, et cetera? And that's kind of at the granular level. It's a very, think of it kind of like an inspection checklist that just keeps going on and on. And then there's a macro task associated that with as well, as which is, making sure that we are prepared for the operations of the future, the compliance regulations of the future, and kind of having a more senior leader's hat on when it comes to thinking about those things and kind of skating to the puck where it's going to be, so you're not caught flat-footed when new regulations come out.
Were you always detail-oriented? Is this something you've always known about yourself?
No. I think so. The reason why I joined Alpha Architect, and I'm sure for veterans looking to make the transition, you may feel the same. I joined Alpha Architect because of the team. I wanted to be with a team of Marines, with entrepreneurs. I wanted to be in a small, lean and mean entrepreneurial venture. And so that's why I joined. And I find that if you have the right team and the right people in place, the job itself, I enjoy the job, but I didn't set out saying I can hardly wait to get a job as a financial regulations expert in the 1940 Act space. You know, no, so that was not my intent. But I'm glad I'm here nonetheless.
And I'm imagining that most listeners have listened to Wes Gray's interview where he talked about starting Alpha Architect. But just in case they didn't, how would you describe Alpha Architect?
Alpha Architect is basically a billion-dollar asset manager in a garage. I would describe it as, imagine a very hungry, entrepreneurial, lean startup environment. We're all cheap bastards. We drive crappy cars. We have a yucky office. We have really bad Folgers coffee for our clients. We are a no-frills outfit, but we just really focus on being efficient and transparent and kind of replicating that Marine Corps ethos that we, you know, came to know and love in the Marine Corps in the private sector. And so that's basically what we are. So in terms of culture, that's what Alpha Architect does. And this background, we're an asset management firm. We manage money on behalf of pensions and high net worth individuals and then everyday investors as well.
And so when it comes to your day-to-day, and I've just gotten a ton of feedback from listeners, they love just to get the nitty-gritty, and obviously no day is typical, but could you kind of just walk us through a day in terms of when you get into the office and what sorts of activities you're doing throughout the day?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I get into the office, luckily, you know, one of the main benefits of being an entrepreneur is there isn't really a set schedule. So if you're thinking about entrepreneurship, you're still going to work your tail off, but if you walk in at 9:15 as opposed to 8:45, that's okay. But I typically get into the office about 8:45, 9 o'clock. And what I've done the night before, I know it sounds a little crazy, but you're constantly firefighting over during the day. So what I like to do the night before is I like to outline what are my top 3 to 4 priorities for that day. What are the must-get-dones for that day? And typically what that entails, I'll sit down, I'll go through my emails, I'll make sure there's no urgent surgicals, if you will, to address that I'm going to add to that to-do list. And then I knock out that to-do list. And that to-do list is typically rooted in one of three areas. First, I work very closely with counsel. So we have legal counsel that we retain. We have legal counsel that represents the shareholders that are part of our ETF complex. And then we have a third-party service provider counsel that also we work closely with. So typically what I'm doing in that role is I'm cycling back and forth with documents or compliance issues saying, hey, you know, this is our position. What are you seeing in the marketplace? What are the new regulations? What is the impact of this decision on this filing, et cetera? So I'll typically spend a lot of time either on the phone with them or emailing with them back and forth or kicking a draft back and forth, making sure that's right. Then the second leg is kind of a, I don't want to say a supervisor because we're a flat culture here, but I'm responsible to make sure our team is doing the right thing. So we have a lot of processes in place that we need to be following. And so I do a lot of inspecting. So for example, we have pre and post trade compliance checks that we do to make sure that we're entering the trades properly, we're executing them properly, and we're following up with clients as needed. I'm making sure that that's getting done. And I'm making sure that, are we saving the files where we need to save them? Are we doing the things we need to be doing? And so that's another big chunk of my work during the day. That typically takes up until about noon. So I'm basically putting out brush fires and doing the kind of nitty-gritty tactical stuff during the morning time. to kind of clear the decks. And then typically what I always try and do is I always try and go out to lunch with a coworker. I don't pack a lunch, and I specifically don't pack a lunch because I want to either be coached and mentored or help coach and mentor someone or just learn from somebody in the office or elsewhere. So try and go out to lunch with somebody for 45 minutes if I can. And then when I come back, that kind of helps me recharge my batteries, and I try and take care of big Blue Arrow initiatives. So I'll give you one example. The SEC, who regulates us, comes out with guidance every year and says, hey, this is what we're going to inspect people on. This is what all firms should be worried about. And this is what you should be thinking about as a compliance officer when we come a-knocking. And the SEC typically will inspect every firm in our business about once every 3 years. And so I will take that memo and I will review it, and then I'll go through our systems and processes and ops and say, okay, what are we not doing that's on this list? What are we doing that could be better? Where are we excelling? And basically just trying to make your compliance program better. So I will literally rewrite a training manual, we have a digital compliance system that tracks all of the activities we do. I will write a new digital process to help our team members stay compliant. I'll present that maybe to Wes. Maybe we'll have a quick powwow with the team and say, hey, I think this is a more efficient, transparent way of conducting this particular requirement. What do you think? Get their feedback, bake that in, and then finalize that. So that's typically what a quote unquote average day entails, but it's all over the place. You know, we have regulators that, as I mentioned earlier, will come in and inspect us. We're getting inspected next week by the National Futures Association, just a routine audit. But a routine audit means I have five auditors from Chicago sitting in our conference room, pulling files and wanting to ask us questions about, how do we maintain compliance with their regimens? We're not only regulated by the SEC, we're regulated by these other entities. So there's no such thing as an average day, but I'd say it basically boils down to, part granular, tactical activities, part, I want to say leadership, mentorship, coaching, supervising, and then that big Blue Arrow, how do we get better? How do we pull our heads out of the trenches and kind of think longer term about just being smarter, more efficient, and more compliant and transparent?
That's great. I mean, I love your description. I appreciate that that level of detail. And, it seems like from an outsider's perspective, you've got the best of the startup world and that you've got that variety. You've got the constant change that keeps things interesting. But I'm also just kind of smiling, thinking, my world coming from submarines, there were these I think it was operational readiness something, ORS exams, these nuclear reactor reviews that everyone always dreaded, and you're always preparing and checklists and training programs and audits and all these things that, that at the time we thought was just singular to submarines. And what you're describing sounds exactly like that, where in this civilian setting, you're constantly dotting your I's, crossing your T's, and just making sure everything is compliant. So I think it's just funny for listeners to think of, they can probably relate to what you described from their military experience, and yet it's very similar on the other side.
Absolutely, and that's where veterans looking to get into finance or operations and being apprehensive, I don't know finance, or I don't know cybersecurity. We leave the service with a GI Bill, with free school for the most part, and we have the ability to basically get free education and learn the vocabulary of whatever field we're going into. But you're exactly right. Operational readiness, readiness checklists, training teams, supervising, those are skills that are transferable across the world. And frankly, most civilians are not exposed to that as much as we are. So there's certainly an opportunity for veterans to get into a field like this. You just have to realize it. You just have to understand that you have those transferable skills.
That's great. That's great. And then what time typically do you leave the office, and do you end up having to work later at night on an average day?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a workaholic. I don't have any hobbies. I'm kind of a loser, to be quite honest. So what I'll do is I typically around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, I need to get away from the computer. So what I do is get away from the computer. My wife actually lives in D.C., so I spend Monday through Thursday in Philadelphia, and then I work remotely on Fridays. But so on a day when I'm not with the family, kind of like a consultant, I will spend You know, after lunch, grind hard, knock off at about 6, get dinner. I go to a CrossFit gym just, you know, down the street, try and kill myself there. I will then, after PT, I'll probably work for another hour or two. I try and knock off about 9:30, 10, and then I just repeat that Monday through Thursday. Now, when I'm with family in D.C., I try and make Friday more of a low-key day, so I'll try and knock off about 3 or 4, having done more work during Monday through Thursday. But like I said earlier, you know, the beauty about being with an entrepreneurial firm is there's no set schedule here. I mean, obviously, the markets are open at certain times, and you have to be online for that for the most part. But, you know, just as long as the work's getting done and you have the independence and the drive to make sure it's getting done, you can shift your schedule around, which I love compared to my more traditional jobs that I held before being an entrepreneur.
That's great. And one of the things I appreciated about my brief time in consulting was it was kind of like pedal to the metal Monday through Thursday, and then you kind of ease into the weekend. And I kind of appreciated that in the military, where it was kind of like I was on deployment, it was all about work, and then when I was home, I was a little bit more present and focused on home. And it sounds like you've got a little bit of that with this remote working situation, where you're away from your family, you don't mind working longer hours, but then when you're back, you're able to have a little bit more time to spend with them and really be present.
Absolutely. I will say, though, the main driver of that isn't necessarily the, you know, the geographical separation between my family and myself. I mean, the main driver of why I have that ability is because of the team I chose to work with. And so I think for any service member looking to transition, a key thing you have to be thinking about is, what do these team members value? If I'm the only person with a wife and 4 kids and everybody else is working, you know, 6 to midnight, and they tell me, oh, we totally value work-life balance, try and get some more data points that support that thesis. Don't take it at face value, because every firm you interview with is going to say, oh, of course we're family friendly. Of course you can kind of set your own hours. Nobody wants to say that their schedule is rigid and it sucks and there's no time to spend time with your family. So I will say, thankfully at Alpha Architect, I just have a team that, you know, really values family and encourages downtime. So that's a good place to be.
That's great advice. I'm curious, do you have any tips for, you know, when you're on the other side of the interview table, how do you tease out whether or not, you know, if someone listening really wants more balance in their life, how do you tease out if that's actually the case versus just what the person interviewing is saying it is?
That is a great question. There's a lot of ways you can go about it. What I try and do is I ask, and obviously you have to be respectful and whatnot, but I try and connect with people that, especially like for consulting, you're probably going to be joining a cohort of your peers. So there's an entire cohort 1 year, 2 years ahead of you that you can reach out to and talk to and maybe grab a beer or a coffee and say, okay, what is the work-life balance really like? You know, when was the last time you were able to go on vacation with your family? Do you have the ability to ask questions? You know, do you have the ability to take vacation when you want, or how flexible, inflexible is that policy? So the first tip is try and find people that, you know, if you're getting hired for a lieutenant's job, try and talk to some lieutenants. If you're getting hired for a captain's job, talk to some captains. Don't just talk to lieutenant colonels and colonels to put in the military speak. The second task is just try and ask smart questions of the interviewer. You know, just ask, where did you go on your last vacation? What do you think about the policy? I think just being transparent and asking direct questions, 99 times or 90 times out of 100, you're going to get direct answers. I think people just fail to ask tougher questions. So 2 is ask tough questions. And 3, you'd be amazed. There's all sorts of people on LinkedIn that have transitioned from those roles. You can reach out to them, especially with the veteran community. Nobody's going to turn away a veteran looking for 10 minutes of advice or a quick phone call 9 times out of 10. So I would say don't just limit your information search to the company itself. There's alums of any corporation you're typically looking at. Be sure to talk to them as well.
That's great. Tip 4 would be order like 3 or 4 beers, and then you'll get some really, really straight answers once they get a little tipsy.
Well, absolutely. That goes without saying.
A lot of listeners tend to, you know, ask questions or email about work-life balance. I get the sense that a lot of people are maybe concerned about this. Maybe there's a perception that on the other side, they'll end up not having a life or not having balance. I'm curious, you've already spoken about kind of what work-life balance looks like for you, but any advice you have about work-life balance or how to, I don't know, keep that or find careers that or paths or firms that might be in line with what someone's looking for?
That's a great question, and it took me 5 years to find the answer to that question. And here's what I think that there's things you can do in the short term, obviously managing up effectively, trying to set clear boundaries and expectations of work and deadlines, clear communication. That's great. I think the key to successful work-life balance is as follows, and it's going to sound a little cliche, but I'll try and get granular. One, it all goes back to the team. If you have a good platoon commander, a good platoon sergeant, you know, good squad leaders, you know, it's going to make it just a much more enjoyable experience. You're not going to really be counting the hours and thinking about work-life balance if you enjoy your work, you enjoy the people you're working with. Two, it's absolutely essential that you're interested in the job. I can't tell you how many veterans I met at HBS that you would talk to them about their job. They'd worked hard to get this, you know, this amazing job offer at Harvard, and they were not excited at all about the job. they were thinking about next steps after HBS. They're like, oh God, this is going to be awful. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'm a vet. They have a veterans program. The recruiting person was cool. I guess I'm going to do this for 2 years. Don't shortchange yourself. What I'd say is, here's the key to work-life balance. Have tactical patience to find the job that you get excited about. Because I think we as veterans, you know, we're all about, you know, we're going to suck it up, we're going to muddle through, we're going to push hard, we're just going to get the job done. And that's great when you're in combat, but that is really tough to do for 3, 4, 5, 10 years because there isn't a clear hierarchy all the time as there is in the military. So I'd say have that tactical patience and really look for that job or jobs that get you excited. That's the key to what I think is work-life balance. I've never had a conversation with Wes, my boss, about work-life balance ever. And that's how I know I have good work-life balance. It's not an issue. It's kind of, there's clear leadership, there's good team culture, and that's what you need.
I love it. I think that's the best answer I've ever gotten to that question. And one of the things that makes me realize is I think that, you know, I'm just projecting here, but I think that sometimes when people are hypersensitive to work-life balance, that might be an indication that they don't like what they're currently doing or, you know, anticipate doing a job that they're not thrilled about. And I can think of so many times in my life when I'm working 80 or 100 hours a week and I'm extremely fulfilled because I really enjoy what I'm doing and I feel like there's a purpose to it. I feel like I'm growing as a person. So I think that's just like an important thing for listeners to remember is that, you know, there's work-life balance, but there's also job satisfaction and they kind of all go together.
Absolutely. And here's another key to work-life balance that nobody talks about in business school, which is maintain a living standard that allows you the flexibility to have that tactical patience. Mm. You know, if you go to business school and ramp up a bunch of debt and go on all the fun trips and have a lot of fun at business school and, you know, get a big house as soon as you get your signing bonus and all that stuff, if you channel yourself into a lifestyle that now requires a very high salary to support right out the bat, all that stuff, you can't be tactically patient anymore. You have to line up that next job perfectly to allow you an out to go to the next one. And I can't tell you how many peers I saw at Harvard make that mistake, that basically, you know, they want work-life balance, they want to find the right job, but their cash burn is $15,000, $20,000 a month, and now they're stuck. The only thing they can apply for are very rare, very competitive CFO-level jobs on the Eastern Seaboard that, you know, 10,000 other MBAs are qualified for and applying for. So that's another thing that, you know, completely separate from career search and career guidance is, you know, if you're in the military, you've had a great life on a relatively low salary. I'm not saying, you know, live like a monk, but think extra hard, especially if you're still in the career search process, about, you know, levering up, taking on a bunch of new expenses. And you're going to feel pressure too, because your coworkers are doing that. And so that's one thing too that I think a lot of people overlook, is to be able to be tactically patient, you have to be financially independent, or at least somewhat so.
That's great. And I'd love to kind of delve in a little bit to your path in getting here. You went, if I'm correct, you went directly from active duty to business school at Harvard. And I'm just kind of curious your advice to veterans about, you know, evaluating whether or not to go to grad school, or in particular an MBA program, and how essential that is if their intention is to get into finance, as you have done.
That's a great question. I think, so first off, the GI Bill just opens so many doors. So if that's still an option, I know a lot of academy grads, they don't have that. But even if you're an academy grad, I'd say, here's how I'd make the business school decision. Everything I learned at HBS, I could have learned with a library card and a couple hours a week in terms of actual core knowledge. I got a great education. It's a great school. I'm not slamming the school. But the concepts themselves were not revolutionary. What was great about HBS and these other top programs is it gives you access to a great network. And same thing with undergrad. I mean, the reason why I'm at Alpha Architect is I knew Wes Gray at undergrad before I joined the Marine Corps. You know, so one of the benefits of going to Wharton wasn't that I became really good at finance. I got a C+ in finance. Don't tell my mother. She never knew that, by the way. But I met Wes there, right? So that's the benefit of those schools. So I'd say if you are interested in business school, look at the power of the network and what the network can do for you. And that's how it evaluated. So if you have the ability to get into a top school, top five school, I definitely go for it. If you're looking, you think you can get into like maybe a, you know, 50 to 100 ranked school and you're going to pay full freight for it, probably not a good idea. I'd also say, look at different business schools and understand what differentiates them. So some business schools might be very good at placing veterans or placing individuals in real estate finance, for example. You know, that's something that at face value you may not know. So make sure you really understand what that school specializes in. And then finally, I would look at what are people doing in successful roles, you know, three or four promotions down the line. And I'll tell you this, this was a fascinating eye-opener for me. You know, so I was at Boston Consulting Group, great consulting firm, learned a ton. And the true CEOs and leaders of the firms we were advising, the C-suite, they didn't go to the fancy schools. You know, some of them had, you know, some of them went to Penn State, great school, got an accounting degree, and just really learned accounting inside and out and had the tactical patience to kind of work their way up the ladder. And, you know, all the Ivy League nerds are working for that person, right? You know, so if you think, I would say don't put so much faith in the school. The school is a great opportunity. It can give you a good network. But it really gets down to grit. And I think people that have the grit and, you know, that are enjoying the work and truly passionate about it, those are the ones that are going to succeed. It doesn't matter where they went to school. And even the degree itself doesn't really matter. One thing I would say, too, is really look into these certifications. So, you know, when you're looking at MBA, do you need an MBA or will a CFA help you? You know, because you may be able to save tens of thousands of dollars and study for a CFA and a CFA charter could do the trick. There's other certifications as well in operations, cybersecurity, et cetera, that kind of follow the same thing. Do you need a master's in computer science, or do you want to get a cybersecurity compliance officer certification? Things like that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I echo what you're saying about that network. I love what you're saying about the grit versus the school, and I love that that you could have learned it with a library card, but that network is really, really helpful. What led you to consulting? What was the thought process of going from business school to consulting?
Well, you know that example of the MBA student that was miserable and not excited? Confession, that was me. here I am. I was trashing myself. No. Disclaimer, first off, consulting is a great place to go if you want to learn, and that's what I was doing. So why did I get to consulting, or why did I choose consulting after HPS? I didn't know what the heck I wanted to do. You know, I basically am looking at my colleagues at Harvard, and they're all Excel whizzes, and they're all strategy gurus, and they're all 10 times smarter than I am. And I'm thinking, how the heck am I going to catch up? How can I compete with these folks? And so that's what is appealing about consulting is that, you know, you are getting two work weeks crammed into one, and you're learning very quickly. And for me, that was a good next step. But I knew going into it that A, it was going to be really tough. B, the work-life balance, and I think BCG does a really good job of trying to support work-life balance as best it can, but it's still a service-based industry and a very demanding work environment. I knew it was not forever. So I did the best I could, got promoted to PL, was able to travel across Europe and Africa with BCG. It was a great experience. But once I had gotten that core skill set that I was looking for, I knew it was time to leave, because if you're not trying to get to the top of the ladder, you're not in the right role. And so that's how I got into consulting, and that's when I knew I had to get out as well.
How long were you there in total?
So I was at BCG. Let's see, I was at BCG almost 4 years.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. Three and a half.
And then, you know, as you're coming to the end of your time there, how does this opportunity at Algico come about?
So I knew I wanted to leave consulting, right? Like a lot of veteran friends of mine, hey, I'm going to do 3 years in consulting and go, but I still didn't know what I wanted to do. And BCG has a great program where they basically say, listen, we're going to give you 3 months full salary or 6 months half salary, and you can just figure out what you want to do. You can network all over the country. You can do whatever you want, but you have up to 6 months. You are never going to get an opportunity like that again. And unfortunately, I was still kind of chained to, well, if I don't have a job, even though I'm getting paid, I'm unemployed, and that's not good, so I need to get a job quickly. And a friend of mine was at Algico Scotsman and said, hey, you know, join the strategy group. It's really cool. We're working on new things. And, you know, that's a natural transition for a lot of consultants. Consultants go from consulting to basically an internal consulting group and then hopefully into a line position with P&L responsibility. And so I kind of just took the easy way out, to be honest. You know, it sounded good. The pay was good. And it was kind of what I was doing. But honestly, when I stepped back and asked myself, am I passionate about this? No, the answer is no. And did I exercise tactical patience to find something I really wanted? No, I did not. I took the easy way out. And there's nothing wrong with Algico Scotsman. It's a great company. It just wasn't something I was personally interested in long term. And then when Wes called me and I learned more about Alpha Architect, I knew, okay, this is what I want to do. And so I'd say, you know, I think Algico Scotsman is a great example of, you know, when you don't have tactical patience, you're probably going to start looking for another job soon. And I think I was only at Algico for about, you know, 6 or 7 months and then took off.
And, you know, what I love about your story, and I think this is representative of most people that I know from business school, is, you know, my experience at Stanford was we all stressed about our applications, talking about what we do afterwards. We go there, we change our mind, you stress about your summer internship, you get it wrong, you stress your second year about the job you do after business school. Most people a year or two in, they get it wrong, you know, then they stress about their next job. And it's kind of like, it's not like anyone ever has a clear direction from the start, but I'm just kind of curious in retrospect, and this is the million or maybe billion dollar question, is there anything you think you could have done? Because, you know, you said a couple times, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I did this. Is there any way you could have shortcutted that, or is that what the process is? Is it about just kind of your best guess and trying and then going and trying again?
That's a great question. I think it's yes and no. I obviously, to your point, you're never going to know an oven's hot until you put your finger on the stove and you learn your lesson, right? So I think trial and error is definitely part of the process. I will say this. I have learned more at Alpha Architect in an entrepreneurial setting in 2 years than I learned at BCG in 4. And the only place I learned more, I think, than Alpha Architect was in the Marine Corps. I mean, it has been entrepreneurship is such an amazing educational tool because it puts what you know, what you're good at, and what you don't know and what you're not good at 5 inches in front of your face. And you have to react to that and deal with that. And you add team complexity on top of that and financing and a P&L. And pretty soon, you've got a very dynamic ecosystem that I think veterans, frankly, can thrive in and do well. And so I would say if you have any inclination whatsoever to do something entrepreneurial, and it doesn't mean, you know, blow up your 401k and start a business. You know, if you know, maybe get an internship with an entrepreneurial firm as opposed to go with one of the big consulting firms. Maybe when you're doing a job search, maybe you don't just look for the top, you know, Fortune 50 companies that do packaged goods. Maybe you look at that innovative startup that's launching its own line of whatever. I'd say try and throw in something that's a little hungry, that's a little risky, and that is going to push you out of your comfort zone. Because one thing I've taken away is, you know, there's nothing comfortable, quote unquote, about consulting or big corporate jobs, but you have that blanket of security, perceived or not, or real or not. You feel like you're in this safe zone where, you know, if a PowerPoint deck isn't perfect, if a strategy review doesn't go perfect, in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to matter, and you kind of can just focus on what you're good at. In an entrepreneurial setting, if you don't get that financing deck right, if you don't get that launch right, that could be the very viability of the company itself. And so I think when you want to accelerate your learning, I think entrepreneurship, if you have the stomach for it, is the way to go.
That's great. I mean, I love the, I think that's such a great phrase that what you're good at and what you're poor at is 5 inches in front of your face. I think that's just, so true. And it's a strong argument for joining a startup or getting into like a smaller team or an entrepreneurial setting where you really do have to learn so much faster. And you touched on something that I wanted to delve into, and it's just something I'm trying to wrap my head around right now. And that's the thought of failure. And the reason why it's so top of mind is that in all of these interviews, I always hear about failures or setbacks or mistakes. And yet, you know, my experience in the military was it's so failure avoidant because the cost of failure is lives or billions of dollars of equipment. There's this extreme aversion to failure. And yet I realize from my own journey and from hearing other people's stories that it's just failure is inevitable. You're gonna hit different spots where you fail. And so I know this probably comes across as a cheesy interview question, but I'm curious if you could think of a time when you failed in your civilian career or where you faced a setback and just kind of what you learned from that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a great book that I encourage all, I don't get a cut, by the way. So this is a unsolicited recommendation, but the book ties to the story here, but Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. Mm. And it talks about when you fail, true leadership, you know, who's at fault or who messed up? That's not the issue. You know, you're trying to identify what did we do wrong and how can we get better? That's all that matters. And when you have the right command structure in place, that should be the focus. So check out Extreme Ownership, but I'll tell you, in times that I failed, I think, especially, like, take this entrepreneurial setting, for example. Well, so one time I failed was, you know, I get to this new entrepreneurial startup, and I'm real excited, I'm real gung-ho, and, you know, we have to implement all these processes and revamp all these processes, and I'm going to apply this Marine Corps structure to everything, and everything's going to be, you know, squared away and ready to go. And I didn't take into account that, lo and behold, you know, there are civilians in this company that might find a Marine officer revamping the way they do business as somewhat abrasive. right? And I didn't think about my leadership approach or style, and I didn't have any glaring failures. It wasn't like we failed a inspection or anything, but I was talking to Wes like 18 months in, and I'm like, man, it's just really tough to get traction with these guys. Like, what am I doing wrong? How can I get better? You know, why is it like pulling teeth? And I stepped back and I said, you know, it's not these guys, it's not the team, it's you, Patrick, it's you. You are not looking into yourself and saying, okay, how do I adapt my leadership style to be better and be more convincing? And so what I learned was that, you know, when you're a veteran being transplanted into a civilian role or a civilian job, one of the best things you can do is display extreme ownership and take on challenges, and I'll give you an example, take on challenges that you may not consider necessarily your turf right away. I'll give you an example. So we were trying to do these compliance checklists and get them done, and every team member had to do one of these compliance checklists, and they weren't getting done promptly. And so what I did was I said, you know what? I'm going to try and just do the best job I possibly can, and I'm going to do other people's compliance checklists, walking them through it with them. So they see how to do it, but it's not going to be from a patronizing standpoint. It's going to be from a, hey, I just want to help you. I want to save you time, and I want to make you the best I can possibly make you. And that, to me, has been a real revelation for me in this setting is, you know, if you go in with that military mindset, there's a lot of strengths. You bring so much experience to the table that just you can't get in the civilian world, and don't underestimate that. But also step back and take stock in the fact that that approach is not going to be warmly received or even understood by a large swath of the population. And it's your responsibility to figure out, how do I adapt my leadership style? How do I take the strengths of my military training and military background and counter some of the potential weaknesses or pitfalls that I could get myself into? And that was a real great, I think, you know, failure is fantastic, and that was a great failure on my part. Was that really was a good wake-up call to say, hey, you, there's a better leadership answer here, and you can be part of the solution and not part of the problem. So that's a very long-winded.
No, I think that's great. I just think, you know, it sounds like you're about 18 months into your role there, and I'm like, man, that's a good lesson. That's like, you know, if you take a 10-year view or a 20-year view on a career, if you spend 18 months and the only insight you got out of it was about shifting your leadership style and shifting that's a well-earned lesson. And I just love the way that you laid that out, but it sounds like something that I think everyone listening can also relate to, of just kind of also recognizing the difference in leadership styles and approaches and really adapting that to the environment and context where they end up.
Yeah. I'll give you one more small example to show how powerful this is. So, you know, general, I'm a neat freak, right? And what I used to do, and I wasn't a jerk, but I'd say, hey guys, let's make sure you empty out your trash cans and stuff. It's kind of getting nasty in here, blah, blah, blah. And it was like pulling teeth, you know? And I was like, why am I having to like tell grown adults to take out their trash by their desk? Like, this is ridiculous. And I get kind of frustrated. And then going back to the principles of extreme ownership, I was like, okay, I can send out another annoying email. Or, you know, I'm just going to talk about why I'm a neat freak and why it matters. And I sent this email to the team. I said, you know, when I went to Iraq, I had this battalion commander I really respected, and he was all about, you know, painting the Iraqi police stations and making sure gear was squared away. And I couldn't stand it because I'm like, why are we painting an Iraqi police station? We have a war to fight. You know, we should get out there. But what I saw was that the victories in small wins and victories in instilling discipline in the unit had huge effects. And, you know, the pride that the Marines felt in this unit was amplified, and they were more squared away, more disciplined, more professional, and it all started with the very simple basic things. And so I wrote this really long marathon email. I talked about, you know, why this is so inspiring, and I said, so, you know, this is, as we finish this office renovation, I'm going to really commit myself to kind of just doing the small things, because I want to show my respect to you guys as a team, but also I think we can really make a difference together. And so I tried that approach, right? Just kind of share, here's why I think this is important. You know, join me if you want, but I think this might be worth trying. I got all emails back like, oh, this is so awesome. Hey, we should do this too. Hey, you know what? I'm getting rid of my trash can because I want to make sure I walk around the office and talk to people, and I'm going to throw it away in the kitchen. You know, and that's such a silly, cheesy example, but it was just one of those things that exemplified, you know, you can still be a military leader. You can still be a veteran with military experience, but it's totally, I think, the antithesis of what you think a military leader might be at times, right? Yeah. That was like the most low-touch, persuasive, you know, do this if you want, but here's just a neat anecdote to, you know, show my perspective kind of story. And it was the most effective I'd ever used.
Yeah. No, that's inspiring. It's really inspiring hearing that. And I love, it's just such a powerful example of just a very, like how you applied what you learned on that. And that's just such a... I think it's very inspiring. You mentioned extreme ownership, and for listeners, I'll add that in the show notes. I'm just curious if there's anything else that could be a book or a podcast or any other resource that you would recommend that's helped you in your civilian career. And I'm particularly thinking of someone who's on a ship or overseas and might not have access to a lot of things, but this is an action they could take today that might help them with their transition or might help them with their eventual civilian career.
So that's a great question. And I wish I had thought about that question when I was transitioning. I would say, well, extreme ownership, we already talked about. This is going to sound cheesy, but I think books are really life-changing, well beyond any type of recruiting tactics or tactical things you can do to prepare to transition. We Were Soldiers Once and Young by Hal Moore, you know, About Face by Colonel Hackworth. Read books about leaders that were challenged with very tough, difficult situations and what they did to lead and inspire others and to succeed. I cannot tell you how amazing it is to read about, and because we're veterans, we're familiar with it, but reading about, you know, these officers, these NCOs, these frontline enlisted that when faced with a difficult challenge was able to react and inspire and motivate and change change the course of events. Because it's typically, you know, one person deciding, okay, I'm going to lead now. I'm going to lead. I'm going to inspire by my actions. I'm going to, you know, do something different. And that has, you know, We Were Soldiers Once and Young about, you know, the Yadrang Valley and the Vietnam War. That is not necessarily, you know, how you're going to get your next job at Facebook. But I think that will, those lessons learned about how you carry yourself and how you stay tough, how you stay resilient, those lessons never get old. And so I know it may not be a career book per se, but I think those books about, you know, great leaders doing amazing things in times of adversity are always a good thing to read and to learn about.
Yeah, and I'll add those to the show notes. I'll add to that as well, Endurance, about Ernest Shackleton and the Arctic expedition. But I love that thought of, you know, this is not interview or resume fodder, but this is just about being a better leader and a better human being and a more resilient employee. I think that's just a fantastic reading list for someone.
Yeah. I think the more, if you change the mindset from how can I help myself succeed to, hey, how am I going to help this company, this firm, this team succeed? It's just, A, you'll be 10x more warmly received by your peers, but B, it just puts you in a different mindset. It puts you in a different mindset about, you know, how you work, how you support your team members. And I've certainly found that as I try and, you know, it's tough, but, you know, as I try and uphold those values, it just makes it for a better work environment all around.
I think that's accessible and relatable for every veteran listening too, because I think that in general, the military community is driven so much by contribution and contributing to their team and their unit and their country and their families. And so I love just applying that in the workforce, which is like, hey, it's not anything complex. It's just how can you contribute? How can you give to the organization and to the team and your coworkers? I think that's something that would click with most veterans. And also, like you said, that's such a great way to succeed and to thrive. I'm cognizant of the we're towards the end of our time, and I always like to keep the last question open-ended. And that's just that, you know, we've talked about so much. You've, you know, been inspiring to me and I'm sure to our listeners as well, and just extremely informative. What have we not talked about that you would want military members on active duty and veterans listening to this to know?
So I think one thing we didn't talk about, or maybe we touched on, is your network is bigger than business school, if you're looking at business school. Like I mentioned, you know, my business partner and best professional friend I could ever have is Wes Gray, and we were drinking beer together in college. You know, I still take time to invest in the relationships I made in the Marine Corps. Don't abandon, you know, you forge these amazing relationships with amazing people and they go on to do great things. Don't let those relationships erode. And I'd say, you know, A, it's extremely satisfying to stay in touch with these people, but two, you know, if you want to be mentored by someone, you need to be able to have a Rolodex of folks you can reach out and ask. And I think too often military folks feel, well, I was in the military, now I just got to really develop these tactical professional skills. I really need to get good at Excel. I need to get good at PowerPoint. I know how to do leadership. But I think that's somewhat short-sighted. You know, don't try, like I said earlier, I make a point to try and go out to lunch with somebody at the team every day. Not because I'm lazy, I don't want to pack a lunch. It's because I want to hear what's going on. I want to develop those social relationships. I want to be able to, A, be a mentor to pay it back to all the people that helped me along the way. But two, I want to get coached. You know, I want to hear about what I could be doing better and things like that. So I'd say make it a professional point to spend, you know, an hour a week, you know, a couple hours a month, and really cultivate that professional network, because you would be surprised who you're going to bump into in the future and how you might be able to help them, or they can help you. It's pretty great when you have a good team of folks that you can work with like that.
Mm. Well, this is exceptional. I found myself during the conversation holding back a couple times because I wanted to make more airtime for you, because I was so much enjoying what you said. I think that you're just extremely, extremely good advice, but also extremely efficient in how you put it. And I know I have been inspired by what you've shared. I know listeners will as well. So thank you for taking the time to share your story with me.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for putting this podcast together. I think it's a great resource for veterans, and just keep up the great work. I'm honored to be on the podcast, but more importantly, thank you for what you're doing for us. It means a lot.
Surface, surface, surface.
Okay, so was I right or was I right? I think that was just such an incredible interview, and I just really found it motivating and inspiring, and I just think Patrick has a great perspective and really does a great job of articulating a lot of things that I hope are useful to you on active duty and recently transitioned veterans. Here's some of the things that stood out to me. First of all, I loved Pat's thought on the top 3 to 4 priorities for the day the night before you go into work. Cal Newport, if you haven't listened to my interview on deep work, definitely either read the book or listen to that interview. He lays out a great system that I still use, which at the end of the day goes through a process of clearing your email, looking at the next couple days of your calendar, and just giving your mind permission to unplug from the workday. But I really like this addition of just thinking through the night before, like, what do I really want to make sure gets done tomorrow? And then I like how he checks in on that the next day, make sure there's no urgent fires that need to put out, but he's ready to just hit the ground running. I thought that was fantastic. I loved his thoughts on going to lunch with a coworker, and it really came through that he, you know, both mentors people, but he's also open to being mentored and just making the use of that meal to get conversations going and to really learn and grow. I love that he talks about, you know, that most companies, and I think this is true, most companies say we are family friendly, or they say we have work-life balance. And I think he lays out a great process for really putting that to the test. And he talked about talking to the person who is in the role that you're going to be working in. Get it straight from the horse's mouth. Is this true? I love the way that he talked about asking smart questions of the interviewer. You know, where did you go on vacation? Things like that to tease this out. And I love, you know, obviously I'm biased on this, but I love the thought of talking to veterans and getting a hold of other vets who work at the company and just getting that extra grain of salt. Work-life balance, this was probably one of the favorite parts of the conversation. I just respect that it took him 5 years to find it. And I love, you know, he points out that it all goes back to the team. It all goes back to being interested in the job. And the phrase that he uses that I love, I'm going to borrow this one in future interviews, is have tactical patience to find the job that you're excited about. And he talks about when you're financially independent, it gives you the flexibility to be tactically patient. And I just think it's great to think that I'm still stuck on this thought, but it's like when you find the right job, when you find the right team, my guess is work-life balance won't be so much at the forefront. And that's even a great filter that, you know, are you working with a team or at a company where you are tearing yourself away to go home rather than just looking at the clock and trying to get out the door. I thought that, you know, given how many people who have been on Beyond the Uniform have gone to business school, I thought he had a lot to add that I haven't heard before. That phrase about, you know, he could have learned this all with a library card is great, and it's all about the network. And so really evaluating the business school based on the network and prioritizing that top five school. And I love that he puts it in perspective. He had two things to kind of counterweight that, just showing that, you know, when you look at people, what they're doing 3 to 4 roles out from school, not to put too much faith in the school, that it all comes down to grit, and how he was often working for people who didn't go to great schools. And I love that he also pointed out that you might want to go get a CFA instead of an MBA. So just kind of picking the right tool for the job that you're wanting to do. I loved when he said, you know, especially given so much work I've done around consulting lately with the Veterans and Consulting Panel and all the data around consulting and all the consulting interviews, I love that he said consulting is a great place to go if you want to learn, especially if you don't know what you want to do. And that seems true. That rings true of my experience, that if you're not quite certain what you want to do, consulting is a great holding pattern, a great way to dig down and get more info without ruling out any options. But I also love, you know, when the passion comes through when he's talking about his startup with Alpha Architect, that he learned more in 2 years there than 4 years at Boston Consulting Group. And he talks about entrepreneurship is such an amazing educational tool because it puts what you know and are good at, and vice versa, 5 inches in front of your face. And I think, you know, he talks about this as an ecosystem that veterans can thrive in. I thought that was so great. And, you know, it doesn't mean starting your own company, but even joining a startup, it really does accelerate that learning process. And then I really respected the way he talked about failure and adapting the leadership style to the situation, you know, taking on challenges you don't consider to be part of your turf right away. And then that final thought of how am I going to help this company or team succeed? You will be 10 times more warmly received, and it puts you in a different mindset to, you know, as you think of supporting your team. And then that last plug, and this is so in line with what I'm doing with Beyond the Uniform, your network is bigger than your school. It's, you know, it's about those relationships with the military and keeping them alive. So that's what stood out with me. I hope that you had different lessons. I would love to hear about them in the comments section on the show notes. I'd love to get a discussion going. So chime in, add your 2 cents. It's a way to get more value out of these episodes by really thinking about them and talking about them and starting to build up that network and that community with other people listening to you beyond the uniform. That is all for this week, except You thought I'd get by without it. Accept that plug, for if you have not had a chance to leave us a 5 or 6 or 7 stars, however many stars iTunes allows, would love for you to give a positive review. Helps my ego. It helps my grandma think that I'm not wasting my life. And most importantly, it gets more word out to veterans who can benefit from this show. So yes, by leaving a 5-star review, not only do you feed my ego, but you also get this out to more vets who are going to benefit from it. Keep the feedback coming. Join our mailing list. That's where I get most of the survey data from to figure out what to do with Beyond the Uniform. And with that, I will be back next week with more interviews with incredible veterans about their civilian career. Take care.